Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We bring you the best commentary on books and film and streaming TV. Listeners might notice this week we have new theme music. It's by composer Matthew Sheffer, and it is 100% appropriately licensed for use by Sea of Reeds Media. All rights reserved. You can't touch us. You can't touch this show. We have a great show for you this week. I'm going to talk to Chief Film Critic Stephen Garrett about Disclosure Day, the new Steven Spielberg movie about alien encounters on Earth. It's a bit of a mess, but Stephen and I have a lot of fun taking it apart, which we always do. I'm also going to talk to Daniel Aaron, our frequent film critic, about Backrooms, which is one of the two movies that has really changed the culture this summer, along with Obsession, which I talked to Daniel about a couple weeks ago. Backrooms is definitely worth seeing, and it's really worth talking about. Also worth talking about is Spider-Noir, a show on Amazon Prime that expands the Spider-Man myth to, you know, 1930s detective story, and it stars Nicolas Cage as the Spider, not quite Spider-Man, but something like Spider-Man. It's an alternate universe thing. Scott Gold is back to the podcast for the first time in a long time, and he's going to talk with me about Spider-Noir, and he's going to do it just like the show, both in color and in black and white, and you can choose whichever one you want to listen to. But first, Disclosure Day with Stephen Garrett, right after this. Yesterday was Disclosure Day, as in the day that Steven Spielberg's new movie Disclosure Day was disclosed to the public. We no longer have to wait for the Steven Spielberg's new take on alien encounters. It's here, and Stephen Garrett has encountered it. I have encountered it. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Thank you for revisiting the trauma of seeing this movie. I think I may have seen this movie when I was 10 and I forgot about it, and then I had a vision or something.
And then it got probed.
I got probed by the movie in places I didn't want to be probed. But okay, here's the thing about me when it comes to alien encounters. I've never personally had an alien encounter, but I am married to someone who's not really an experiencer, but she's an enthusiast. Member of this sort of UAP community. She goes to conferences. She knows all the lore. She follows the press conferences and the file revelations and all that stuff. We watched Age of Disclosure.
I was going to say, I bet she loved it. I loved it. That was fantastic.
Yeah, Age of Disclosure was the real Disclosure movie. That was great. You know, it's like Marco Rubio, our sitting Secretary of State, sitting there saying, yeah, aliens are real. And like, and we just like went on with our day. We're like, oh, got to go to Trader Joe's. Aliens are real. Okay. But okay. So you have that movie sitting right there, right? And then you have Steven Spielberg with Disclosure Day. Now, full disclosure, over the weekend, my wife tied me to the bed, just like Josh, what's his name? Josh O'Connor tied Eve. First of all, if you're going to tie Eve Houston to the bed, give me a payoff other than just seeing her tied to the bed. You know, she didn't squeeze the wand like she did later in the movie.
The device. Please, it has a name.
The device. The MacGuffin. The interstellar MacGuffin. There are two of them. Two interstellar MacGuffins. So we watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And you know, which is an all time classic movie. It was on Criterion Channel.
Ah, it's terrific.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the thing about Close Encounters is, it's full of just beautiful, brilliant imagery, incredible, you know, just small, the small details that you know, that made Spielberg the filmmaker that he is today, as well as like sweeping global set pieces, that scene in India, that scene in Mongolia that comes out of nowhere.
Well, and very tellingly, all those scenes that you're referencing that are so memorably etched in our minds, it's not about the dialogue or the script. It's about sitting in this moment and seeing these things happening.
The filmmaker.
You know, like Roy. The filmmaker. Like, I mean, it's Richard Dreyfuss, like, at a cross, you know, at a train crossing, and an alien coming down and and shooting its light at him. You know what I mean? Or the little boy being taken away. None of these scenes have dialogue. This movie is nothing but dialogue. It's car chases and dialogue.
Yeah.
Oh, unless I'm missing something.
No, I mean, that's the thing. I was waiting for a memorable visual. But I thought Disclosure Day's script was awful. Awful.
It's very bad. It's not good.
One of the worst scripts I've ever, you know, well, because you mentioned this in your review in Book and Film Globe, right? It's like your main character is...
We buried a lead. I dissed Disclosure Day. Let's just say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I agree with you.
And I think you join me in that.
Oh, I agree with your review completely, Stephen. I mean, the thing is, your main character is Josh O'Connor, who plays Daniel Kellner, which is, that's really all you really, and he's a computer genius. But you're right, for the first 30 minutes, it's just like you're watching him running around, being chased by Men in Black, essentially, led by Colin Firth, who, I mean, the wall of computer screens in Colin Firth.
There are so many. I mean, it's almost like, right? It's a serious sight gag. Like, that should be in a Naked Gun movie.
I'm like,
there are so many computer screens on the monitor.
And it's not necessary.
I mean, on the wall.
It's not
necessary. And what are they tracking? Like, what are they tracking? Yeah, are they tracking alien landings? Because there are not that many of them.
Right, there's like happens. It happens once every few years. It's like you could probably just have a couple of computers set up. You don't need to. it was absurd. You know, it was like
it's absurd.
It was absurd, and I'm like, but they don't tell you what they're tracking or why Josh O'Connor is important, and then Josh O'Connor is running around with this woman who I guess used to be a nun.
Yeah, that's like out of nowhere, like, oh, I used to be a novitiate. And you're just like, what?
Well, they need,
okay.
I need a safe place to go. Why couldn't he have just gone straight to Kansas City where Coleman Domingo, first of all, I hated that Coleman Domingo character so much.
He was building a sitcom set. He was building the 90s sitcom
right,
set.
Right. I'm like, are you recreating Home Improvement? I mean,
I think it's Full House. It might be Full House that he's recreating.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not too sure.
There wasn't even a Full House. They didn't even use the house. Why do they even need it?
I don't know, because the thing is they put their little nodes on their heads and then they start hallucinating because of the aliens. So, like, you don't need to be in a set at all. You could do that at
somebody's. Yeah, they weren't even
in a hotel room.
Yeah, exactly. You know, anywhere, really. It could have been at the White Lotus. I don't know. I mean, the whole thing.
What is this movie?
Well, you know, and then you don't get to the alien shit until, like, the last half hour. And then suddenly the entire world is looking at their phones at the same time.
Right,
with wonder as opposed to doom scrolling.
Which, like, hilariously, the press screening I went to was on like the night of the Knicks game, one of the Knicks games.
Oh, yes,
this week.
Right, so everyone was
looking at their phones. I was like, oh, they're probably watching the Knicks game. That's probably what's happening right now in this movie.
Yeah, and that was the greatest NBA game of all time. So it's like they were looking at their phones with actual wonder, you know. I mean,
that was nail biting.
I mean, and that's the thing, though. This is, you know, okay. If this is like some random sci-fi movie that screens at South by Southwest and then you never see again until it appears on direct-to-video, it's one thing. This is a Steven Spielberg movie. And
oh, we forgot to mention the world's about to end.
Oh, and the world.
But can you tell me why? How is it ending? What's happening?
North Korea, something, something.
Something, something, the Koreans, Kim Jong-il,
you know,
like something,
and then, you know,
military bases,
in the middle,
something, something.
In the middle of all this, you have Emily Blunt acting her ass off as a tortured weather woman from Kansas City.
She's doing her best.
I mean, she's
doing her best.
Doing all kinds of accents and like changing facial expressions and like, I don't know what's happening to me, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, I don't know what's happening to you either because the movie hasn't told us.
Yeah,
at all,
and then she has these little like intimate moments consoling total strangers about crap that's going on in their lives that they feel bad.
Yeah,
about.
She's like,
it's okay, it's okay.
She's like, I'm sorry, your dog died. I'm like, his dog died.
Jimmy will find another security blanket. It's okay.
I'm sorry,
you're a good dad.
You're a good dad. I'm sorry, you're an abused wife. I'm like, don't. You just don't.
I'm like, what?
You don't just randomly trauma dump a character with two lines. You can't. How, you know? There's no. Yeah. So, and that's the thing too. Is like the direction's all wrong. It's like they're going north, but they didn't go north. They went from Kansas City to Indiana. And they're like, oh no, wait, they're going east. I'm like, yes. That's true. Yeah, and so, you know, Close Encounters, which has all this global scope, most of this movie takes place in Kansas City and Indiana. And I'm like,
also, incidentally, what did you make of that scene where Colin Firth is probing Eve Hewson's brain to get GPS directions? I'm like, right. This is the silliest scene I've ever seen.
I'm like,
this is not tense. I'm not at the edge of my seat.
I'm like,
do I turn right or left? Ah,
dirt road.
5 miles down the road.
Dirt road. I'm like, what?
Dirt road. Ah,
what? And then it's like, and now you will pick up a butcher knife. Like, what the fuck?
I know, exactly.
This is what you're using this technology for?
Oh, it's so weird. And what is that technology? What does the device do? You can invade other people's heads, maybe, but it exhausts you and you can get a heart attack if you don't do it right.
And
also, if you hold it too tightly, you burst into dust and then you regenerate.
Right.
And then, 'cause that happened to some character. But you can also turn everything invisible.
Right.
So it's like a Harry Potter-like cloak. Like, what?
Yeah, the technology is not explained. The aliens are not explained. And then, you know, and then at the end, like, they disclose, well, I'm gonna fucking give it away. The aliens are real people. They give it away. The whole world sees all the footage. And that's fine. But, you know, the thing is, the whole, just the, everything was, the pacing was all off. The characters were, Josh O'Connor, who
what?
Is a, one of, you know, our modern cinematic reboots, was awful in this movie. Awful to
He's
watch.
He's such a soft boy. He's like very,
no.
Like slowly talking.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Dude, what did you make of that alien footage of like Nixon with John Candy looking at dead aliens? Like I was so confused.
What the hell
is happening? Why did he bring, they were like, oh, he was a popular, oh, that's Nixon with a popular entertainer in 1973. I'm like, why is he bringing this popular entertainer in Florida to go see dead aliens in a morgue? Like, did they then kill the entertainer afterwards so he'd never talk about
it? Should have been Elvis.
Like, what? It should have been Elvis.
Yeah, and then, Elvis.
That would have made more sense than John Candy.
Yeah, and then Elvis, the aliens took Elvis, and Elvis is still alive, which is the movie I would actually want to see.
That actually would be great. That would be a big disclosure
Right there. Okay, you know, my wife says that this movie captures the lore of experiencers very well. So a lot of the details of, you know, spoiler alert, Emily Blunt and Josh O'Connor were abducted by aliens and given special powers when they were 10, which should have been
when they were 10, which
should have been the first scene of the movie, by the way.
Yeah, that would have been good.
Right. That would have been like, oh my God, they're abducting children and the children are scared. Spielberg, you know, instead he saved it to the last 10 minutes and we have to see it in the flashback to a horrible John Williams score, by the way, like music written by a man in a nursing home. I swear to God.
So this was interesting because I was like watching the movie, I was listening to the music and I was like, oh, I guess they don't have John Williams anymore. Maybe he retired. And then at the end of the credits, I'm like, oh, music by John Williams. Okay. That's great. Incidentally, Spielberg's editor, longtime editor, famously long time, Michael Kahn, right? Yeah. Part of me was like, oh, I wonder if Michael Kahn edited this movie. And I looked up his IMDb credits. He's 95. He stopped editing Spielberg movies sometime around like West Side Story.
Yeah.
Or right before.
You know, we've.
And I'm just like, oh man, these guys are getting old.
Well, here's the thing.
They're getting old.
Elsewhere in this show, we talk about Backrooms. We've talked about Obsession. These are movies made by the next generation of filmmakers. Spielberg is two generations past that. And, you know, look, it's not to say a man who's 79 or 80, you know, still can't make a great movie. I mean, there have been directors who made movies into their 80s that were good, you know, and Martin Scorsese's movies certainly don't blow a tire like this one did. But, I mean...
Right.
But this is an all-time turkey as far as I'm concerned.
It's bizarrely bad. And, you know, like, talk about movies about obsession. Like, that is Close Encounters. Close Encounters is one of the great movies about obsessions and people being obsessed about things to the point of insanity. Like, these people go virtually insane and destroy their lives in pursuit of alien contact, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and there's a huge difference. You know, the sort of gritty realism you see Roy Neary's life depicted with, you know, he leaves his family.
Leaves his family? Like, what?
You know, Josh O'Connor... We don't, you know, there's no stakes, you know, no, you don't ever
see. There are no stakes. There are no stakes. And you don't understand what their relationship is, him and Eve. Did they just meet?
Yeah.
Like, we know they've had sex because she's like, I'm not a nun because we've had sex. You're like, okay, Tell me more about your relationship. Have they been together a long time or not? How did they meet? How much do they care about each other? Because he's risking life and death to save her.
The only thing to watch in this movie is Eve Hewson and Emily Blunt. Both of, they're the only characters in the movie who are the only actors who seem to be trying, and they're the only character they're the only characters who are even vaguely interesting, as far as I'm concerned. But they're still like playing in service of this god awful script.
It's crazy.
It's a crime. The script is a crime. Yeah, if you want to like, and to me, like it's an insult because we do live in an age of disclosure, as we saw in that documentary, where we now know that something involving aliens or unidentified phenomena is real. But this movie is like a strange hallucination, and it's sad because Spielberg has made not only a better movie about this topic, but the best movie about this topic.
Yeah, pretty much, hands down. Like, and Disclosure Day is the best documentary I've ever seen.
Age of Disclosure.
Alien Invasion. I'm sorry. Age of Disclosure is the best documentary.
So here's what we're
about aliens being among us. That was fascinating. Yeah. You got to give details that really draw people in. This just had some weird, like the videos were kind of odd. There were some kind of cool videos we see at the end in that big moment where everything's disclosed, yeah. But also they raised a lot of questions. Also, like the aliens keep crashing into Earth. Like, what is happening there? Like, why do aliens keep crashing into Earth?
They're drunk.
That alien totally looked drunk, by the way.
The alien at the end,
up at the alien.
They wheel him in some big chair, and he's like this ancient alien. I'm like, where the hell has he been hiding? Here's the Book and Film Globe recommendation. If you want to see movies,
our recommendation is go see Close Encounters.
Yeah, see Close Encounters and watch Age of Disclosure. You can buy it on Amazon Prime. Disclosure Day I almost like seeing a movie this bad because it just gives me faith that there could be that movies can be bad again. I love that.
Yeah, and the thing is, I'm not a Spielberg hater. The last two movies I reviewed of his, I loved. Like, I gave 5 stars to Fablemans, 5 stars to West Side Story. I mean, the guy can rise to the occasion if he wants.
Of course.
This is just baffling. Yeah. It's baffling.
Baffling. All right, Steven, the truth is out there. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Been a very surprising season at the movies. You had a couple of films that came out of nowhere, really, to take the culture by storm. The first was Obsession, which we talked about on the last episode, and I have the same writer here to talk with me about the other movie that has really captured the zeitgeist. It's called Back Rooms, and our contributor is Daniel Aaron. And he reviewed both Obsession and Backrooms. And in fact, Daniel, you just told me you saw Obsession for a second time yesterday.
Yes, I did.
There aren't a lot of movies that you go back to the theater for a second viewing for.
Yeah, I can't even remember the last horror movie that I went back to see in the theater twice. But yeah, it held up amazingly. I was a little worried that the discourse would have burned me out on it, but no, it's great.
Yeah, there's been endless discourse about Obsession, yep. Actually. A lot of it having to do with, how much the people who worked on the movie got paid. But, I mean, it's not like this was some, big budget tentpole picture. I remember one time I interviewed Josh Brolin for a magazine feature. It was right after he filmed No Country for Old Men, sort of before the Brolin sons, right? That was really the movie that brought him fame. And he spent half the interview complaining to me how little the Coen brothers had paid him. So I don't when people talk about how the art director for Obsession didn't get paid a lot of money, I can't say I don't have any sympathy, but it's like, yeah, well, it's an indie. It was an indie. They thought it was a kind of an indie film. It just turned out to be the biggest smash of the year. Slightly less of a smash, but still super significant, is the movie we're talking about this week, Backrooms.
Yes.
Which was directed by a 20-year-old named Kane Parsons, who sort of drew on I guess like a trove of internet lore that started on 4chan and spread around about, you know, liminal spaces, about back rooms. You know, someone posted a photo, I think on 4chan, of like a yellow carpeted, yellow wallpapered, empty office, and it became this thing online.
Yep. Yeah, really like harsh lighting and just like, you know, kind of like, you know, seeing like a mall or department store that's normally filled with people is just spooky in this situation where it's not. So I can see how they ran with it.
I mean, not only did they run with it, they ran with it to the extent that it's now like forever imprinted on our sort of horror consciousness as a thing. And Backrooms, I thought, did a pretty effective job of taking basically like meme culture, you know, in YouTube and Reddit and 4chan meme culture and turning it into a feature.
Yeah, definitely. No, I mean, to touch back on what you said really quick about the, you know, the budget situation and what they're paying for stuff like, you know, I have a little bit of a cynical view about the fact that they're kind of giving these, you know, YouTubers like these, you know, big time chances to direct these movies. And it feels like a little bit of like, you know, trying to avoid, I don't know, like you get like a first time director and stuff and give them like a lower budget than you would give someone else. And but that said, like, you know, Backrooms and Obsession are both fantastic, like best case scenarios for that situation. So, you know.
Well, I mean, these are, you know, Kane Parsons and Curry Barker's the guy who directed Obsession. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be cheap guests from now on. So, you know, so in some ways it's just the spark of creativity and inspiration, I think, that Hollywood needed. And, you know, Backrooms is an extremely idiosyncratic film. What I thought was interesting about it is that it's made by a 20-year-old. You know, Obsession was made by a 26-year-old, and it's about 26-year-olds or younger people, mm-hmm. younger than that. You know, the main two characters of Backrooms are people are in their late 30s, mm-hmm. You couldn't have given me two actors whose names I have a harder time pronouncing, Chidiwell Ejiofor and Renate Reinsve. Mm-hmm. I think I got those right. Are your main characters. But, you know, it's like the Ejiofor character is like this. You think he's the main character first. He's this extremely unlikable, mm-hmm. very unlikable, alcoholic, abusive, low rent, furniture store owner in suburban LA in like 1990. And he discovers a back room in his furniture store, in the basement of his furniture store, and he gets sucked into this alternate reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the premise, but what the movie does with it is an extremely interesting experiment in psychological horror.
Absolutely. And I was struck by when I think Kane Parsons was interviewed by someone and he ended up saying something like he's strongly against AI. And I personally think that, you know, there's a lot of images in the movie that are sort of commenting on AI. You know, you have like when you first had those generative AI apps like DALL-E, where, you know, you're making faces with too many eyes or features in the wrong places. The movie, it's hard to not think of that stuff when you see like the beings that they eventually encounter in the back rooms. And I personally felt that there was some commentary. You know, Clark is this really, as you said, this unlikable guy with alcohol problems, and he can't take responsibility for his actions and his divorce. And to me, the movie feels a little bit like it's at least, you know, brushing by the idea that there's, you know, these men now who kind of create this AI bubble for themselves, and they can't handle the accountability of reality, and they just kind of like, you know, live making stuff on the internet that makes them feel better about themselves. That was one of my takeaways anyway.
I guess you could kind of come at that from the side, but at the same time, a lot of the images he creates, the people with the sort of the bizarre faces and the furniture sunk into the floor, yeah. and the, you know, a lot of that is just, you know, I think it's just, these are images that you can encounter with AI if you're using these generative tools poorly. Mm-hmm. But he also is just using, you know, more conventional effects to make them. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the imagery is actually any different. It's just that, you know, it's I think to me the movie is more a commentary on, like, you know, just how our psyches are twisted.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And you know, and the back rooms concept, which, you know, as Geo4's character says, it's everything that ever was. It's just kind of like the collective human subconscious, and then once you're in it, you're like in this dream state, and even if it's horrifying, you have this hard time escaping it.
Yeah, yeah, it's almost like a literal warehouse for, like, I don't know, like random piles of furniture and random memories that have been discarded or remembered wrong, and now they're all, you know, messed up and stuff. So yeah, it was a really cool kind of visual metaphor to see how they drew that stuff out.
And he likes it. He doesn't want to leave it.
Yeah, that's kind of why I felt like it was a commentary on that, because he's like, oh, you know what? I actually prefer this to the real world. So,
well, I don't know. I mean, look, I'm not as anti-AI as you are, clearly, but I mean, I can appreciate, you know, and I think that, you know, if Cain Parsons had used generative tools to make these images, I don't think they would have been any less effective. You know, and also I gotta praise Renate Reinsve here, because, you know, she's an Oscar nominated actor. I don't know if she'd received her nomination already when she filmed this, but she won for Sentimental Value, mm-hmm. or was nominated for Sentimental Value, which is, you know, pretty fairly realistic, you know, Euro drama. But, you know, she just steps right in and is like this, you know, final, basically like a final girl, although she's no girl. She's like plays a, mm-hmm. you know, a psychotherapist in her mid-30s, and she steps in and plays this, you know, horror protagonist with just full commitment. Mm-hmm. She's fantastic in this.
Yeah, definitely. Like, yeah, all the, you know, the limited number of actors in this, her and Chiwetel are both, you know, really, you know, what's the word? Kind of reserved. Like, you feel like this underlying tension that's going to explode in their performances. And yeah, they're really good in it. Although I do feel the set design and all that is the real, you know, star of the film. But yeah, everything is really well done in it, shockingly so for, you know, I wouldn't consider like a 20-year-old to have that kind of subtlety in his, you know, I don't know, vision. But yeah, it was really,
it's the ultimate it's the ultimate vibes movie. Mm-hmm. It's not good vibes, but vibes for sure. And, you know, and I thought it was like extremely well paced.
Yes.
You know, my 23-year-old son, who, you know, does one of the last members of Gen Z who goes to the movies, said it was unlike anything he's ever seen in the movies. And I tend to agree with them.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff where I would see like little bits of things. Like I saw like little bits of what I would say, you know, Michel Gondry style visuals a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously like David Lynch is going to come up and a little bit of Cronenberg and stuff. But no, there's definitely stuff in this where the ambiance, you know, just having a scene where you just, you know, the yellow back room with the harsh lighting and just a stop sign that's written backwards in the center of the room is just, you know, really, it's a weird, disturbing thing to see a stop sign in the middle of any building, really. And you don't even think about it until you're just, you know, watching someone else look at this thing, like how did this get here? So yeah, it was really effective in a very minimalist way.
And yeah, and it's a horror movie with very minimal gore. There's one scene that is mm-hmm. extremely violent, in the back third. But other than that, mm-hmm. it's just kind of like sound design, you know, sort of, you know, heavy breathing, kind of creepy corridor wandering, mm-hmm. and not much else.
It's true, and I mean, honestly, that's a classic horror thing. Like, there are so many horror movies where the best part of it is just, you know, wandering through the darkness, waiting for something to happen, and, you know, just feeling your pulse quicken. I mean, you know, a little bit of Blair Witch and some of the more handheld camera scenes, but yeah.
I've seen some talk that they're going to merge the back rooms and Obsession universe. And in fact, you know, Curry Barker is making a sequel to Obsession featuring a One Wish Willow. So what's going to happen real fast with this stuff? These are extremely original movies that will, you know, either stand the test of time or will be like very definitively, you know, 2026 cultural landmarks. What's going to happen is, you know, within a few years, you're going to be in, you know, Friday the 13th Part 4 territory.
Yeah. And they're definitely going to be, both of them are going to be imitated a lot. And that's sort of where I'm worried that the low budget YouTube directors are really going to be diminishing returns, but we'll see. I mean, these two both, you know, give a lot of hope for for what you can do with very newcomer young director who just hitting the ground running.
It's one of those rare moments where you see the culture shift.
Yes,
and it has definitely happened, and it's going to become annoying very fast. But I love it when it happens because genres get stale, and these two films, along with this Apple TV show Widow's Bay, which we talked about on this show, I feel like have really kind of revived the culture in a way that I didn't see coming. So I'm grateful for that.
It's very cool.
It's nice to see things change. So Daniel, Aaron, you have joined me yet again. Just be careful, just when you're walking around your house, because you never know. You never know. A back room could open up at any time, and you're not coming out if you go in.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to go in.
That's what you say, but it'll find a way.
Maybe just to grab a backward stop sign or something. But thanks for having me.
Sure. That's how it starts, Daniel. Just when you thought the superhero genre was played out, it might be played out, who knows? But there are still fresh ways to do superhero movies and TV shows. And one of the more interesting takes on superheroes this year is a show on Amazon Prime called Spider-Noir. It's a spinoff of the Into the Spider-Verse movies, starring Nicolas Cage, of all people, as essentially a Spider-Man, although in the show he's called the Spider, and he's played like a 1930s hard-boiled detective who also has a spider powers. And I found the show, I'm a longtime Spider-Man fan, and I found the show lots of fun to watch, and it's definitely worth talking about. And in order to talk about it, I have brought back from the dead one of our favorite Book and Film Globe contributors. Mr. Scott Gold is here to talk with me about Spider-Noir. Hello, Scott.
I'm not dead yet.
The boss wants to see you, Scott.
It's great to be back, Neil.
The boss wants to see you. Why don't you come and have a seat, and I'll pour you a drink, and we'll do some exposition.
Oh boy, this never goes the way you want it to go.
There's a lot of that in Spider-Noir. There's a lot of like the boss wants to see you, and then the boss sees whoever the boss wants to see, and then next episode the boss wants to see them again. I found the script like kind of repetitive in some ways. Like there are a lot of the same scenes, but when it cooks, when the show cooks, it really cooks, I think.
Oh yeah, I really really enjoyed this show. And what I love about it is that I think you're right about, superheroes being played out. And there's one big thing that's been kind of inching me towards not really being as interested in superhero movies and TV shows anymore, is because there are so many series and they're all interconnected, especially with Marvel, that there's every series has so much baggage. Yeah. And what Spider-Noir does really effectively is go into a completely different universe. Yes. That is not connected to any of the other films or TV shows or properties. So it's essentially like a whole new fresh story and a different take on Spider-Man that we haven't seen before. Spider-Noir existed in the comics, but if you haven't read the comics, and you have to be a big like comic book nerd to have gotten to the point where you're reading Spider-Noir, it's a really cool take. And you can tell, that everyone involved was having so much fun just playing up and digging into those 30s detective film noir tropes and like all of the stuff that is just so ingrained in pop culture, that it was just really cool and different. And it was also Spider-Man, but it was, not the same Spider-Man that we were used to. So it felt fresh and it felt fun.
Yeah, I would agree. And I don't think anyone was having more fun than Nicolas Cage, who, thank God too, because he's in pretty much every frame. He's not in every scene, but he's without him, the show would not exist. He plays Spider-Man, but really what he's doing is kind of playing this this private eye character named Ben Reilly, who's kind of an amalgam of like Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney and Edward G. Robinson and Jimmy Stewart. And it's to the point where you actually see him at the movies, like watching a James Cagney movie and doing an imitation of James Cagney while he's watching the movie. And he's just so...
Yeah, it was a... It's such a fun performance. Yeah. And he said in an interview that his two biggest inspirations for this character were Humphrey Bogart, obviously, and Bugs Bunny, which comes out in some of the more fanciful detective work when where he's like pretending to be someone else and joking. And it's, you know, it's definitely leans into a little bit of that, you know, Raymond Chandler, Philip Marlowe, snappy dialogue, you know, good comebacks, you know, repartee that you would expect from like the same kind of writing in the 1930s that kind of, you know, heralded in this age of noir cinema. And it's just great to just watch him go. Like they clearly just said, all right, like do your thing and it's going to be fun. They let him off the leash.
Yeah. It's a very physical performance. Like he has, you know, kind of, you know, he's bitten, not bitten by a radioactive spider. And a really creepy scene, actually, he's bitten by a mutant who's being experimented on by the Germans in a prison camp during World War One. He just has, there's just a lot of physicality to him as he tries to deal with the fact that his basically he now has a spider exoskeleton, which, you know, he's still like a person, but not really. And he has to actually go, he says he has to watch these movies in order to learn what it's like to be human again, which I thought the movie plays it almost for laughs, you know, not quite, the show plays it almost for laughs, not quite, but it plays, there's enough humor in it so that you're not feeling burdened by his trauma.
Absolutely. And you know what's really interesting is that without that little bit of exposition or that little bit of writing to kind of say, oh, there's a reason for this, it would just come off as just Nick Cage being bonkers. But it's weirdly grounded to who this character is, and kind of he throws in these erratic spider-like like movements, like his arms will like flip, like jut out, and his legs will jut out.
Yes,
not something you expect from Spider-Man.
The way he cracks his back, he's, you know, because he's in his early 60s, you know, so it's not like a, you know, teenage Peter Parker. I mean, when you know, you can feel it when he gets the shit kicked out of him. There are some other performances to talk about in the show. Brendan Gleeson is sort of the main villain, a mobster named Silvermane, and I feel like he has to do the same scene over and over again, but he's good. And I also liked Lamond Morris plays Robbie Robertson, who is a character from Spider-Man canon. He's like a sassy, hard-boiled newspaper reporter. I thought he was funny. I also loved the woman who played his secretary, Janet.
Karen Rodriguez plays Janet Ruiz, and she was an absolute delight. Yeah. And I was just so enamored by her performance, and I hope she gets a lot of work because of it, because she just killed it.
Yeah, I agree. Like she, you know, every scene she was in, I was like, I wanted to see more of Janet because she was a lot of fun. However, I will say I wanted to see a bit less of Lee Jun Lee as the femme fatale of the show. Felicia Hardy is the character from Spider-Man. Kat Hardy is her name. She's like a nightclub singer. Romantic interest for seems like half the male cast. Not that she's not, doesn't she looks phenomenal in this. She's beautiful and she has, you know, great outfits and she's not a terrible actress. I didn't feel like the character. It felt very one note to me.
Yeah, and honestly, like it's going to be hard keeping up with this, you know, cast because they stocked it full of a lot of veteran actors who are just so great. And I get it. You know, she was a little one note, and I think a lot of that had to do with the writing.
It was the writing.
Her character I think it was the writing, and it really wasn't her performance necessarily.
I would agree with that. You know, but that character in the comic books is also a superhero. You know, sort of
she's Black Cat, right?
Yeah, she's sort of like the Spider-Man's version of Catwoman in some ways. A different character, but at least similar. And I felt like it would have been cooler if they'd given that character some, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing Lee Jun Lee in a you know tight cat outfit. So maybe I was just hoping for that to happen. But I mean, I'm only human, Scott.
I was really kind of surprised that they didn't set that up a little bit. But I guess that's probably because we don't know if there's going to be another season.
I think there is. I think they renewed it. I could be wrong.
They did.
I could be wrong. All right, but there are other bad guys, right? So there are basically like versions of the Sandman, Electro, even they call him Megawatt in the show, but he's clearly Electro. And then the Lizard, I guess, that big black guy with the scale.
That was Tombstone. actually.
Wait, who was Tombstone? Tombstone is not a...
Tombstone would be the comic book character.
Okay, that's not even a character. That's post when I was actually a Spider-Man fan. I don't even know Tombstone. But all right, so... But there are analogs to, you know, Spider-Man villains. I kind of felt like they soft-pedaled the villains a little bit, too. Like, they made them... Other than the electric guy... They made them almost good and sympathetic, and I what I love about Spider-Man is the sort of like cackling Snidely Whiplash aura of his villains, you know, and it didn't quite get there for me. And also,
right, and it didn't, yeah, they wanted to make them complex. They wanted to give them a little bit of depth. I get that. You know, we got Jack Houston as Flint Marko the Sandman, who was so great in Boardwalk Empire and weirdly playing like almost the same character.
Yeah, and it was
as a soldier who was like disfigured in World War One and then has to work for the mob. Like, that's literally the same guy.
He was better in Boardwalk. I think it was just the writing. You know, he spent a lot of time like grimacing and clenching his fist. Honestly, there are some great set pieces in this. That episode in the haunted laboratory was oddly terrifying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was straight, like, David Lynch, Cronenberg, body horror. It was such a terrifying and wonderful dream, like, fever dream sequence.
Well, it was like, they referenced Todd Browning's Freaks in the show. It reminded me of that. It reminded me of, like, a classic kind of, like, Sam Fuller's Shock Corridor. Like, it was clear that they knew what their antecedents. It was like, or like a 1950s horror movie. Like, they knew their antecedents. That episode was great. And there's lots of great stuff in it. I just feel like, you know, my one criticism is it's just a lot of repetitive story beats, you know?
I agree. Like, it wasn't narratively tight the entire way through, but visually and performance-wise, that was enough to really carry it through for me.
Yeah,
because,
me too.
I mean, you got to give it to Nick Cage. He never phones it in.
No, he was amazing in it. And, well, okay, and then one more question before I let you go into the night to defend your city. New Orleans, you live in New Orleans. It needs a spider. Did you watch it in black and white or in true view color?
This is a really good question, and I was really hoping we would get a chance to talk about that. I started watching in black and white because I thought that was kind of the intention of the character and the show and kind of what I knew about Spider-Noir. And when it's film noir, I kind of feel like I have to watch it in black and white. And so I got a couple of episodes in, and then I was like, okay, let's see what the color's all about. And the color version is hyper-saturated, like the Dick Tracy movie back in the day with Warren Beatty. Yeah. And it was like, after watching it in black and white, it was too visually overstimulating. It's gorgeous and intentionally saturated, but I was like, no, this feels too distracting to me. Like, I want to go back to black and white, and I finished the series that way.
I had the exact same experience. I watched like half an episode in the color, and I'm like, no, I can't do this. The black and white is good enough. Cause you want to feel, you know, you wanted to feel like you were immersed in this world, and the world, it's a noir world. It's a noir pastiche, but it's a noir world. And, I feel like that's the sort of the show's true purpose and true calling. And I would love to see a second season because, you know, this is like oddly enough the role that the late Nicolas Cage era role he was born to play and that we were born to watch.
Yeah, I mean, he's wanted to be a superhero for so long, and he's had moments of it, you know, in Kick-Ass and, you know, a couple of other things. You know, when he was younger, he really was gunning hard to be Superman. Yeah. But he finally gets to be the superhero here. Albeit, you know, the older kind of broken down Spider-Man, you know, in the very, like, the trope of the assassin who's hung up his weapons and has left the life to become something more safe and then gets dragged back in, which is, you know, it's something very familiar. But, you know, he was so great. And I love just watching him do his thing.
Yes.
Like, when they allow him to do that and just, like, run with it, because it is... You know, anybody else it would be tiresome, but it's just so entertaining to watch.
Yep, from pole to pole, for sure. And if you love Nicolas Cage, this is a must addition to the canon. And it's on Amazon Prime. I recommend it. I mean, I don't give it my highest recommendation, but I would give it a strong recommendation. And it sounds like Scott.
Three and a half hundred radioactive spiders coming out of an incision in my torso.
The boss still wants to see you. How do you take your whiskey?
Empty? I don't drink anymore. I'm going to have to go with the Coca-Cola.
All right. Well, get this man a Coke. Scott Gold, great to talk to you again.
Thanks so much, Neil. Great to be back, man.
All right. Thank you so much, Scott Gold. Great to talk to you again about Spider-Noir. It's great to talk to you about anything, but Spider-Noir is our topic this week, and that's airing on Amazon Prime. Also, thanks to Daniel Aaron for talking to me about Backrooms, which is still in theaters, and to Stephen Garrett, as always, for talking to me about Disclosure Day, which is also, at the moment, still in theaters. I am Neil Pollack. I am your host. I'm the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Let me reiterate once again, we have new theme music this week. It's by composer Matthew Sheffer, and it's 100% appropriately licensed for use by Sea of Reeds Media. All rights reserved. This podcast episode will air in perpetuity until the end of human civilization. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you soon.
Audio Hoppa.